Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado, to today's episode. After completing a graduate program in marketing, Mark O'Dwyer began his sales career in Allied Irish Banks, Pitney Bowes and Panasonic before succumbing to his entrepreneurial spirit in 1992 when he set up his own business, Irish International Sales. Initially, this company was a reseller for Take 5 accounts and payroll software. Within 4 years, IIS became the largest reseller of Take 5 in Ireland, acquiring four other Take 5 resellers. He also found time to set up two mobile phone shops under the Sell Your World brand and a web design company offering website design services for small businesses. In 2001, he bought the majority share in a small Irish software business, Big Red Book. At the time, the company was losing money. The company became profitable within 6 weeks, and Mark then acquired a payroll company to complement Big Red Book's accounting products. In 2003, IIS were appointed as channel partners with SAP for their new SME product, SAP Business One. Mark sold his Take 5 business and concentrated on developing this new market for SAP, and in 2008, IIS was bought in an MBO. He launched Big Red Cloud in June 2012, the online version of Big Red Book, which has been a huge success with customer retention rates of nearly 94% and unparalleled customer support. Mark sold both Big Red Book and Big Red Cloud in April 2005, at which stage the companies had supported over 75,000 businesses. He is also outgoing chairman of ISME. Mark, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks,
Aidan. I hope I got everything in there.
Yeah, no, sold it in 2025, not 2005.
2025, yeah, sorry.
I hadn't sold it before I'd made it. Yeah, thanks, Aidan. Nice for you to have me here.
Right. When you look at IIS, what came first, being an entrepreneur and finding the business or having an idea or a problem to solve and creating a business from that?
It was really a circumstance, Aidan. I had spent a number of years selling very well for other businesses and making them plenty of money. And I had been poached back to Panasonic Business Equipment to set up a division to sell laptops and printers. And the deal was that if we reached a certain target, they'd set up a separate company, I'd get a percentage of that business, and we'd rock on from there. We did that. We went 180% over target. And in the January, we set up the business. And in the February, Smurfit, who were a joint venture with Panasonic in Ireland at the time, sold out their share to Panasonic. And then Panasonic looked at their divisions and their distributors and saw that the laptop division was trading at 180% over target. And they said, we're taking that back in-house. So they took, basically they pulled the rug from under my feet. And I was given the opportunity to go back and sell fax machines and photocopiers. I'm not one for going backwards. And Panasonic offered me the job of product manager, which was fine. However, it suppressed my personality for a year working for Panasonic. Not that they're an absolutely brilliant company. And I learned a lot from the Tony Tanimoto, the Japanese managing director. But I wasn't myself and I knew there was more to me. And that really was the tipping point where I said I wanted to set up my own business. And having sold accounting software for Orchard Software, It was Incomplete Records for accountants in practice. I set about looking for a financial software package that I could sell, and that happened to be Take 5.
Mm-hmm. What were the pros and cons of moving from that kind of big organization and a sales focus to kind of a smaller organization and managing the whole thing?
Oh, there's massive pros and cons. The pros was I got my personality back,
right,
and I got a bit of mojo back into me. The cons were, during my time setting up that division for the Panasonic Business Equipment, we were selling so much, I moved house and I got a bigger house at a mortgage that I could afford at that time. But the Panasonic job was a set salary, permanent and pensionable. That was great. But the commission, there was no commission there, and I was earning serious commission previously to that. My wife was a stay-at-home mum, and so you've one salary, you're not earning the salary you had, and you've moved to a bigger house, a bigger mortgage. So that was a major con. Yeah. And if we hadn't hit something like 1800 GP by the 18th of the month, we had to, make sure that we weren't spending too much on groceries and the like. And so it was a challenge. And then, you know, you go from a bigger organization, as you say, where you have all the support, all the admin, where they're doing all the invoicing for you, they're doing the deliveries, they're doing all the collection, and they're doing the trading profit loss and balance sheet, to having to do it all yourself. So you have 2 hours of selling and 6 hours to do everything else.
Yeah. And that is, it's always interesting. I talk to people who have set up the businesses. Like, as an entrepreneur, you have to wear an awful lot of hats. That you were a brilliant salesperson, but you may not have had the other skill set. So, you know, do you think when you look back in it, it would have been better to have some co-founders that could have done the other bits for you and let you do what you were good at?
Yeah, so I did have a co-founder.
Okay.
And but he was very good at doing deliveries and driving, you know, 10 miles to fix a keyboard for a customer. So from a customer service point of view, that was excellent.
Yeah.
But he was also meant to be a co-salesperson as well.
Right.
And after 2 years, it turned out I was doing 77% of the business compared to his 23%, and we weren't making money. And so we just came to an agreement where I assumed the business. We had losses at the time. Yeah. I assumed the losses and he left the business.
Right. And then what about getting other people along to help you? Or did you outsource it? Or could you have outsourced some of the other tasks, like the financial or whatever that was done at the time?
Yeah, so we did outsource. One of the things I would change now, looking back, is I would have put more working capital into the business.
Okay.
Very important for startups to make sure they have enough working capital and that they forecast out far enough. You know, don't just do 12 months, do 2 to 3 years of cash flow forecasting. That's not something I did. And so we couldn't afford to take on people. So we did do outsourcing. And one of the stipulations of taking on the Take 5 agency was that you have to have a support person and a salesperson. I was the salesperson, but we couldn't afford a support person. So we got a guy on contract.
Okay.
And he basically did the support on his mobile phone and we paid him per call.
Okay.
So that was a workaround that.
Fair enough, yeah. In desperate times, desperate measures.
Yes. My dad was retired at the time, so I got him to do the deliveries.
Right.
And then I just did the paperwork at night. But I did realise that was starting to fuel the fire for me internally, that there had to be a better way for small business owners to use an accounting package that was more simpler for people who didn't understand the accounting package.
Yeah.
So that was basically certain.
That was the little light bulb maybe that went on to the next next bit that
came
exactly
through. That's
exactly it, Aidan, yeah.
Yeah.
You've set up a lot of businesses along the way and scale businesses along the way. What do you think have been the key learnings as a serial entrepreneur, right? An awful lot of people you kind of talk to, they have the one and they've lots of learnings, but they never necessarily get the opportunity to apply them a second time round or a third time round.
I guess sticking to the knitting is one of the key areas I would suggest is something people should consider. So I dabbled in mobile phones, I dabbled in web design, I dabbled in sports businesses. The most successful business I had were in accounts and payroll,
right,
and software, basically software related basis. So I, in my opinion, you're better off sticking to what you know. And our focus was always on customer service. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of cases, those businesses were either failing or not making money because they weren't supporting their customers and they were losing more customers than they were winning. And that was an opportunity for me because I was able to get in, buy their business at a reduced figure,
mm-hmm.
and then get in and put our magic dust on it, which was really, really good.
Mm-hmm. And do you think the product could have been anything really when you think about it? Like you mentioned, the light bulb with the accountancy software, but I'm sure if, you know, a very good salesperson, you could have had anything. It could have been anything.
Oh, yeah, no, it could be anything. Yeah, yeah. No, it's once there's something that can be sold that has a margin that's decent enough to sustain a business moving forward and grow staff, grow customer base and have the potential for future acquisitions, it can be anything.
Mm. And you know, you've obviously, you took the businesses on and you scaled it. When you think about the difference between scaling a business and setting it up from like pure scratch, you know, what we see it an awful lot of times, there's an awful lot of very good entrepreneurs who start the businesses and get it to a point but can't scale it. Do you think there's a very different skill set on the scaling side?
Oh yeah, there's 100% different skill set. But you somebody can have both.
Okay.
So in order to scale it, you need volume. In order to get volume, the quickest way to scale is to acquire other businesses and then really put in proper structures, strategies and a management team to scale the businesses that you've put in, because people can do that and they can fall asunder because they don't always gel together. Mm. And it's key to be able to, when you buy a business and you're taking staff on, that they are part of the journey from the past, that, from what's been successful. And if they're not going to get on that train, then you need to make the hard decision to let them go, because you really need to be laser focused in your vision on where you're going with that business. And if somebody isn't going to come along with you on that journey, they're just going to drag you down.
And what about developing culture in that type of environment? Like, it's a very different thing to start something fresh. You can kind of mold the culture the way you want to be, but you know, you're very unlikely to find a whole load of targets that have the perfect culture to.
None of them do. None of them do. So that's really important. So one thing I learned early on in my career was that employ people that can do jobs that you can't do and let them get on and do it. And if they make mistakes, mistakes can be fixed. And when you endorse a staff member with that amount of confidence, they tend to give you back more than you could ever want. And so I've been very lucky over the years to have really, really good staff that have helped us formulate that culture where we let people get on with the job they're doing and we go in and support them if something goes wrong. Mm.
And then from a staffing point of view, are you more a develop from within or parachute from without?
It depends on the circumstance at the time, Aidan. Yeah. You know, it's different horses for different courses. Yeah. In some cases, yes, of course, we'll develop from within. And sometimes that can work against you. So we had a policy where the longer you were with us, you were then entitled to the next step up the ladder. Mm. But just because you're one of the best players on the team doesn't mean you're going to be a great manager. Yeah. Doesn't mean you're going to be a great coach. You don't necessarily have those inherent skills within you. And so sometimes we made mistakes and then we'd have to adopt the Japanese way, which was if you and I, Aidan, were working in a Japanese company like Panasonic, and we were both really good friends, but you were absolutely brilliant and needed to be promoted. We'd both get promoted, but I'd get promoted to a window seat only so I wouldn't be belittled in your eyes.
Okay.
So there was a little bit of that went on where, you know, we put people up the gravy chain and they weren't necessarily able to deal with it. And then we put somebody in to help them solve the challenges.
The other thing too, I'm always interested in is that idea. If you want someone to act like an owner of a business, you have to make them an owner. And people automatically think that I need to have a shareholding or something like that. But I'm not convinced that an actual shareholder. It can be more, as you said, about people feeling involved in the success, whether they are an equity holder or not in the business.
Yeah, that's the way I operated over the years. At the end of the day, in April of this year, I still own 90% of the business. Mm. And my business partner owned 10%. But we had a lot of owners with responsibility within the various divisions within the company who were very committed. Long-time serving employees, Aidan. Mm. 25 years, two people were 20 years, 18 years. Sales manager was there 15 years. But they really owned their area and that was enough for them. And they felt they were part of a team. They felt they were listened to. And they felt that we acted on decisions that they made.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier on about you kind of had an entrepreneurial spirit. Where did that come from?
That's a good question. I think it probably goes back generations. Right. It wouldn't have been from directly from my dad. My grandfather, my great-grandfather would have been quite a successful businessman. Mm. My grandfather did own Davy Byrne Pub.
Okay.
My granduncle used to own the Olympia Theatre. Where all that wealth went, I've no idea, by the time it came to me. Now, don't get me wrong, my parents were middle class and they invested in our education. We went to private schools and gave us a great upbringing and a very strong family culture. But I think it must be in the DNA, you know, back in the generations. You know, they say it takes three generations to regenerate the wealth.
Yeah.
But, you know, it certainly I started from zero. Mm. I had £2,500 what I started the business with.
Mm. Do you think entrepreneurship is an art, a science, or a mental philosophy as an entrepreneur?
Okay, so that's a really good question. So my youngest daughter's just finished international commerce in UCD and her last module was entrepreneurship and they were teaching entrepreneurship. And she said, "Dad, this just can't be taught. Like, this is either inherent in you. So is it a science? Is it an art
or a philosophy? A mental philosophy?
Do you know what? I think it's probably a combination of all three, to be honest with you. Yeah. It's not one over the other. But I do think that there is a certain type of personality that leads itself well to entrepreneurship. Mm. You do need to be very resilient. You do need to be a risk taker. You do need to be prepared to work under serious pressure. And you do need to be prepared to make the hard decisions when the time is right. Mm.
And on that point then, what were the truly hard points in your journeys, both your journeys, if you will, the first incarnation as an entrepreneur and then the second one with the Big Red Books?
The hard journeys, well, the first was the when we realised I was doing the larger percentage of the sales and having to part with my business partner at the time, who I'd worked with before, and that was quite difficult. And it was basically, not only was I parting with him, I was now 2 years down the line. We had built up a debt and I had assumed responsibility for it. And I still had that big mortgage and I still had my wife working as a stay-at-home mom. So I was taking on even more risk at that stage. So that was a challenge in the earlier days, buying up some of those other resellers and skeletons in the closet. Mm. You know, you think you do proper due diligence, but that's not always the case. You know, some things get missed. Mm. And when they get missed, then it's all about how you handle that situation. We did try to grow the Take Five business by natural growth, organic growth. And that wasn't that successful. We tried to go into the UK because we were doing really well here. As you said, we'd become the biggest reseller in Ireland. So we took on an Irish guy in London, got an office, and after 6 months, he was doing nothing. And so I went over to let him go. I think he knew I was letting him go because he didn't show up with a laptop. He didn't show up the keys of the company car I gave him. And it took me 6 weeks and a private investigator to find the car. And that was just an unmitigated disaster. Yeah, so then I realized at that point in time that while you can get a certain amount of organic growth in order really to inject the business in the right direction, acquisition was the way forward.
And do you think that was just the nature of that business at that stage?
That might have been bad luck with the individual that we employed. Mm. It might have been a little bit ego-based that we were doing so well in Ireland, then, you know, far off fields are greener. Why can't we do this in the UK? And I might have been better off spending the money invested in and growing even more in Ireland at that given time. And then you asked, you know, in the Big Red Book, when I took that over, obviously you mentioned culture. Mm. So I took the majority share in that and the existing managing director stayed in as a joint managing director. He had a development mindset. He was a developer, and after a couple of weeks he didn't really like some of the decisions I was making. I'll give you an example. One of them was the introduction of the euro at the time, and he wanted to give the upgrade to convert the Big Red Book to euro free of charge to customers. I said, no, we'll charge them. And he said, no, that's not going to work. And I said, look, I tell you what, we'll give customers a choice. Mm-hmm. So we said, look, you can buy this, which will convert all your customers, all your suppliers, all your products within 5 minutes to euro, or you can do it yourself. And we made $250,000 out of that. And your man decided to leave the business at that stage. So that's where clashing cultures can either go with you or against you. But it was probably the best decision for him to leave at the time and just let me get on with what I was doing. Then I'd inherited two salespeople and employed two more salespeople. So we got four people on the team. We split Ireland in two. Top half, top two had a senior and junior on the top half of Ireland and senior and junior in the bottom half. And I just realised they were both making commission on each other's sales. And I realised the junior people were just riding the storm and making money on their senior person sales. So I decided to bring them in, change their commission structure. And the next day they came in and all four of them handed a notice in. So we had a trade show the next day. So the two sales senior guys went to that. We let the two junior people go. And then the following week, the senior people left. And I went out and did 10 demonstrations and I got 9 orders and realized if I produced a video of my demonstration, we could get more sales. And again, that saved over 200,000 in salaries and compensation packages.
You mentioned an interesting one. You know, that whole idea of the clash of cultures and things like that, that you can sometimes end up hiring what I would call a talented asshole, right? They might be brilliant salespeople, but the collateral damage that they leave everywhere is just not worth it. Or you as the CEO has to make that call of worth it or not, you know, Why do you think is it better off to cut them loose?
Oh yeah, like if they're in and they're destroying the culture that you've built up over a number of years, but they're selling really well.
Yeah.
The actual cost, inherent cost to the business, it's more valuable to get rid of them to save the culture mm-hmm. than to have somebody there making you money. So you can get new other people that might do half the business, but will, you know, dial into the culture that's there. Mm-hmm. And it'll give a better, you'll also get more respect from your existing staff who have been working there prior to this other person coming in. And
so there's almost kind of a halo effect from the decision.
Yeah, but that's one of the tough decisions business owners and entrepreneurs have to make.
Yeah.
And a lot of them just don't make them.
Yeah.
And then it just turns.
And it happens more often when you're doing acquisitions because you don't really see the people. Going back to the point of the due diligence, there's, you know, If I'm trying to sell a business, everybody's on their best behavior. You don't see that necessarily when they're in under the hood.
Yeah,
you
know? Well, that can happen with people. It can happen with businesses. But in an instance, I'll give you a circumstance. We bought a business that sold primarily into schools, payroll, and it was only 100 schools, but it was four times the revenue per customer than our existing payroll. But those schools, with due respect to school, anybody who's listening that's involved in schools, those schools gave my support staff so much hassle. They were ringing every day. We got more calls out of those 100 customers than we did from the 6,500 business payroll customers we had, to the point where I kept it for 18 months and then I sold it.
So it wasn't about the sales. It was actually when you did it on a P&L basis, it just wasn't worth it. You weren't making the returns out of it.
No, they were draining my customer support staff.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a person. It wasn't a business. It was the customers that were the challenge in that instance. Mm. So we decided to, we're cutting loose, we're getting rid of those customers. Mm. So sold it on to a business that dealt specifically with schools,
right.
I could handle that, but we just couldn't handle it.
The thing about the customers too, that customers are and a lot of times great at telling you what's wrong, but not telling you how to fix it, right? Yeah. So how do you kind of deal with that, and how do you try to see it from their side to solve the problem, because they're not going to give you the solution?
Well, in a lot of cases, the customers don't necessarily know the solution.
Right.
But they can be very demanding and they just want. So get in front of them and have a good chat with them is probably the best solution, I would say, to that situation. Sit down with your staff, do an analysis of what the build up to this issue has been. See if we can analyze it ourselves, then go and present what our analysis is to customers, and then see if you can actually get an answer out of them in some form.
Yeah. As you became the CEO of the business, was it hard for you to, because you're an innate salesman, so was it very hard for you to leave the sales function?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, not only is it hard for you to leave the sales function, but then you move to a SaaS business and you actually aren't customer facing any longer. It's all about driving digital traffic to your website, take out a free trial, and then they sign up. Yeah. So there's no personal face-to-face meetings around that. So that was really, really difficult, because I like getting out and meeting people. I like making phone calls. You know, I'm a people person. Mm. That was one of the most depressing parts of the job, I have to say. Yeah, I couldn't. It's very smarty to pick that up.
But that's what I do see it in novel, particularly with businesses that have switched to that virtual thing, because you have people who are really good salespeople because they enjoy the function of sales and everything that it brings. And then you're suddenly saying, oh, no, you don't need to do that. Just bang a logo up onto the website and that's it done. You kind of go, well, what's the sales function?
Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah, well, now the sales function is digital. It's AI. It's no longer people per se.
Yeah.
But that was very difficult, I have to say. And being in the background and, not customer facing was a challenge.
As a CEO, you don't necessarily get better at the job, but you do, I think, get quicker at making the important decisions. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. Well, you need to get quicker
at
making the important decisions.
Yeah.
Now, you can get quicker at making the wrong decisions as well if you make them too quickly. But if you have informed yourself with as much data about the current circumstance as possible, 9 times out of 10, with the experience you've had building up to that point, you will make the right decision. But you're better with a quick, bad decision than a slow, good decision.
And then in that regard, are you, when it comes, are you a gut feel or a data driven decision maker?
I would say I'm gut feel,
right?
But my brain works very fast, so I actually consume data very quickly. So it's gut with a lot of data.
But people
won't necessarily believe that, because I guess they don't understand that I can actually take
process it very quickly at speed. Has fear of failure ever been a driving force for you?
I would think it has. Yeah. I'm very, very focused, very motivated. But I would think, I think anybody who is a CEO that is driven and motivated has a fear of failure.
Yeah, but not a worry about it, I suppose. That's the difference, I think, for a lot of people. I'm afraid of something, I won't do that, whereas you are more, you just don't want to fail, as opposed to being afraid of it.
I would step into more things I'm afraid of on purpose.
Yeah.
To prove that I can actually get it right and be successful, as opposed to shy away from them. Mm. So it's not a case of that I'm worried about it. Not the least, you should not be worried about it. If you're worried about things, you should not be an entrepreneur. At any given moment of time, we were owed $2.5 million with the SAP business. And the more I was owed, the sounder I slept.
Right.
And I couldn't really understand that until I did an Enterprise Ireland and TUD international selling program, where they did a personality profiling test on all 80 entrepreneurs before you went into it, because they had to match you up in teams throughout the program. It was a 9-month program. And at the first meeting of all 80 entrepreneurs, the girl who did the profiling said, see that room? Type A personalities, all risk takers. You're the only one whose profile came back as a double risk. So I'll risk the risk. So I'm not afraid of going in to situations, I guess because I have inherent confidence in what I believe my ability is to turn something around.
But again, if you think about it, the fact that SAP owed you the $2.5 million or whatever, it was a sign that you were doing well. It wasn't the risk. The risk was, it would have been a bigger risk if they didn't owe you anything, because it meant you weren't selling anything.
No, that's true. But they're long implementation scenarios. So anything from 6 weeks to 6 months, and anything could go wrong in an implementation.
Okay.
So would mean then you have fronted the cost of your consultants to do the implementation. You could be 6 months into it, and then they could decide to cancel the deal.
Okay.
And so there was a risk in it.
Right. When you think back to the business and the various different iterations of it, right? As you get bigger, was the risk of innovation or service level falling? You know, that's always something you see in overall. Companies get bigger, because, and going back to the point you made about customer service being absolutely key for you. As you get bigger, there is that risk that the service just diminishes. So how did you deal with that, and how did you drive to make sure that didn't happen?
Yeah, so when we set off on the journey for the Bigger at Cloud, we thought that for every 1,000 customers we gained, we needed another support person. We started with 5 people in 2012. We ended with 5 people in 2025.
Okay.
And the reason we did that was because we brought in lots of content to help customers. So we had frequently asked questions, untold amount of frequently asked questions. We had video contact, we had training videos. So we brought in and used tools to help the team there to give the support that the customers required, and really made the software really simple and easy to use, so that customers were actually self-supporting themselves.
Okay.
And they only really came to us when there was, you know, a big issue, maybe an incorrect nominal figures need to be adjusted or something like that, and need us to dig into the bottom of the system to sort it out for them.
Do you obsess about the small things?
Yes, too much. I do. Why do you ask that? Is that because what you
No,
think?
I asked it out of everybody.
Do you?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm ridiculous about small things.
Yeah.
And it's to the point, it's absolutely, it just doesn't make sense. Like, my wife is at me all the time, like, just like really, really stupid things.
Right.
And I put more effort into them than the bigger things.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know the answer. I haven't got the...
Well, it's funny because I've asked it all the time. I asked that question. And the best answer I've come back with people that have said to me is, I obsess about small things, yes, but it's only because they're important.
Okay.
The ones that are important. And he's, you know, there's lots of small things they don't obsess about, but he said, you know, and there's lots of big things that aren't important that I don't, that, that this person didn't obsess about. And I thought it was a very interesting thing that actually there can be small things that are really important and big things that are really important, but there's equally big things that aren't important and small things that aren't important,
you know,
and it's having that ability to judge the difference between the two. I suppose the other question, and it's less of an issue, I suppose, with you for you, but wearing a wider hat with the kind of the ISME thing. How important do you think it is for your capital investors to be aligned with you and the goals for the business?
That's really important,
right?
Because if they have invested with you, they're going on a journey. They've trusted you that they'll put their money in with you. And they've trusted that you are going to deliver on the results. So if they're not aligned and issues happen along the road, which there will be inevitably, there's always issues. It's important for the entrepreneur to know that they have the trust and the confidence from their investors that they realize the entrepreneur will make the right decision and they will steer the ship in the right direction.
And then in a similar way, I suppose, you know, how important is it that or how do you manage your board or your investors then when things aren't going well?
You be upfront.
Right.
You just throw data at them so that they are fully aware that you were on top of your figures. It's an area in the business, you bring in the manager in that area to explain what's going on and where they see the future solution coming. That gives them confidence that at least we're on top of it and that we have a strategy on how to resolve the situation in the future. So you kind of smother them in data. Never hide anything from your investors. That is the worst thing you can do because, you know, it'll come out.
The trust.
It breaks the trust. It'll come out in the wash at some stage and you're better off just overloading them with their information. And in some cases, they might come up with a solution for you and you just use them as a sounding board.
I mentioned earlier the outgoing chairman of ISME. How did you find the difference between operating as a CEO and operating as a chairman?
ISME is very, they're lobbying on behalf of small businesses. They're the largest small business representative group in the country. There's 10,500 members. And there was a lot of noise, Aidan. So, you know, it's a voluntary thing. Mm. It was me giving back to business, giving some kind of direction to small businesses. And but every day there was WhatsApp messages, there was emails, there were phone calls, there were meeting ministers. There was challenges within ISME itself that needed to be sorted out and get the organisation put in the right direction. I brought in a friend of mine to implement a strategy plan that we had paid a consultancy firm to do, but it hadn't been implemented. So brought them in to make sure it was going in the right direction. And I'm happy to say that I've left the ship in a very good order. But being chairman and you're dealing with multiple different so there's 9 people on the board, Aidan, and there are 27 on the National Council. So once a month, you had a board meeting and a National Council meeting. And because of today's environment, that was a mix between in-person and hybrid.
Yeah.
And you're trying to run it to time, to schedule, because these people are all giving their time free of charge. And you're trying to give everybody enough time to have their piece without going overboard. So it's, you just need to be firm. Yeah. You need to give people a certain amount of time, take on board what they're saying, and then try and implement some of the good ideas that they suggest.
Yes. Switching a bit now, the motive to sell the business, you know, did you just want out or you just couldn't or didn't want to take it further? What was the trigger point for you to sell the business?
The trigger points, that's a good point. So an entrepreneur at one point in time will need to decide they're happy to sell let the baby go. And that happened to me a couple of years ago. I thought if somebody comes in and offers us money, yes. I sat down and asked myself the question, if that was the scenario, would you be interested in selling, Mark? And the answer that I answered myself was, yes, I would. So we were up against the largest public companies in our space, such as Xero, Sage and QuickBooks. Mm. And we did extremely well and were very profitable and had our own USP, which was that customer service and simple and easy to use. But it was a challenge every day because you're up against these guys. They had deeper pockets than you to spend on marketing. So you had to come up with smarter ways of marketing. And I just thought, you know, I was going to turn 60 in January. I thought it was probably time that I should move on and move it on to somebody else who might have a little bit more energy, bit younger, and drive the business more internationally than I did. And so that's...
And do you think a sale was always going to be the exit for you?
Yeah, I have four daughters and none of them were really interested in the business. Okay. So the youngest, who knows, she might come back and say, hey, she's going to go and she's joining CRH in September to become an accountant. So right. Who knows, and 4 or 5 years, you might say, oh, I would have loved to have taken the reins a bigger edge. Yeah. But at this given moment of time, that is not the situation. And so always a sale or maybe a merger where I stepped back and I kept a small share in the business was going to be the future.
And at this stage, do you regret selling?
Absolutely not. Are you having a laugh? No. I keep telling everybody, like, I wanted to sell. Yeah. I didn't need to sell.
Yeah.
And it is quite a landing. So we sold on the 4th of April. That was a Friday. And on the Monday, I was at a job. Mm. And I go at 150 miles an hour all the time. So that was a little bit of a surreal situation. But I have absolutely no regrets. I'm really enjoying the time now. I'm setting myself up for the darker days of October, November, winter. I did a bit of consultancy. I have two startups looking for me to help them out. Mm-hmm. I know my personality will get involved in something moving forward. And
go back to the shop floor and get back to the sales role.
I'd love that.
Would you?
I really would love that. No, I really love sales. So yes, I would love to go back to sales. But no, I'll set something up. But I've a couple of holidays planned. I've trying to get the golf handicap down. I'm playing paddle. I'm training for another half Ironman. So, you know, it's fine with the summers, but I'm a real estate and I know who I am. And so there will be, if I found a business that was in trouble, I'm really good at turning them around.
Yeah.
That would be of interest to me as well.
Yeah. And just in the other thing, I suppose, from the perspective of the sales process, we always tend to focus on the acquiring company and how they're going to integrate the target. But from the target company's perspective, and I've talked to a lot of people who have sold businesses, it's not just about the money. You want to make sure that the place your business is going to it's going to foster it well. The staff are going to be well taken care of. The ethos, as you said, the customer service ethos is going to be continued. It's the new owners believe in the same things that you do. When it came to that process, how important were those other non-financial factors to you?
They were really important because when I took over Big Red Book, I felt I was taking over as custodian of the brand.
Yeah.
It had been set up by a firm of accountants in Clonskee in Dublin called Brian Phelan Associates. And I really felt at that stage I was taking over custodian of the brand. And then I wanted to hand it over to somebody else who would move it into a new dimension. And keeping the staff was really important for me. I did do a bit of visualization on the scenario I was looking for, Aidan. That included the figure I wanted to get for the business, the scenario I wanted for myself, which was not an earnout and not to be involved in the business, and that they were going to keep the staff. And I was lucky enough to get that with Stuart McCall. He had worked for a billionaire in America before in Texas, buying up software businesses. He'd come back to Ireland to educate his kids and he wanted to do this himself. Mm-hmm. And so he has a big plan for the business. He's putting in all the playbook for that at the moment, where he'll be able to take on other software businesses and integrate them in a seamless manner within Big Red Cloud Group. We were a platform play.
Okay.
Because Big Red Cloud, as many people may or may not know, was horizontal. So we weren't vertical. Mm-hmm. So we weren't in specific business. We were in multiple different businesses. So the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. So he has the opportunity to cross-sell multiple software solutions into that base.
Okay.
So that's why when I say a platform, we were a platform. And we were doing a bit of that ourselves with different add-ons. And that was really important to me, Aidan. And I am very lucky that I got the scenario. Everybody's happy. Yeah, and it's what I hope for.
A win-win.
Yeah. And I think that may be why I don't regret. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is the case for an awful lot of people. And you mentioned something about the platform there a second ago. You know, with success comes the risk of distraction, right? And you could have easily started to do all of that, buy up other software businesses and start pumping it into the platform. But there's always that risk that you stray from what looks like a great idea on paper turns into be a nightmare.
Yeah, so we did have add-on solutions and exactly what you've said there, our salespeople's focus was taken off selling bigger at cloud, where we're making the most margin, to selling these add-ons and making money for our partners.
Yeah.
So in a lot of cases, we had to right the ship and go back in the right direction and say, look, guys, can we just concentrate on the bigger cloud sales? Mm. So that is a scenario. Now, we did buy a inventory management solution from a chap in Galway. In May 2023, he came up, he was integrated with Big Red Cloud, he was integrated with Sage, he was integrated with QuickBooks, he was integrated with Xero, and he came up to have a meeting with me just to get more business. And at the end of the meeting, I said, I'm going to buy the business off you. And that's turned out to be a really good opportunity that we have for the business, because we're now marketing that in the UK. And instead of having to go spend money marketing the bigger cloud brand in the UK, this product links in with Sage, Xero and QuickBooks.
Okay.
And for Xero's scenario, for example, the most successful inventory management solutions are coming from New Zealand. So the support is, you know,
Wrong time zone.
And we're more highly featured and we're at a better price. So it's been really successful in the UK. But I was working on that at the background, knowing that if the sale didn't go through,
you still had that.
Yeah, but you have to be like, some business owners
can't be dependent on the one outcome.
Exactly. But some business owners are dependent on it. And then when it goes awry, which it did for me, by the way, on two occasions, one acquirer pulled out 2 weeks beforehand and one acquirer pulled out a day and a half beforehand. So you need to dust yourself down and keep going. But you have to have the business going in the background anyway.
Yeah. Do you hate losing or love winning?
Do I hate losing
or love winning?
I love winning.
More than hating losing. It's a subtle difference, but the amazing people.
I love winning.
You love winning.
Yeah.
You're straight up winning.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to decision making, are you fast or slow decision making?
Fast.
Fast. Gut based, data backed, fast decision making.
Correct.
Right. What advice would you give young people today? Either career-wise, life-wise, whatever. You've 4 daughters. So
well, I was lucky in that having made the decision to go out on my own and having managed to grow it eventually after the 2 year. So you really need 3 years for a business to be successful. Mm. You know, the most business will go out of business within the first 3 years. So once I got past that scenario, owning your own business gives you an awful lot of freedom. Mm. I was able to be at home every day for dinner with my girls. I was able to go to all their hockey matches, all their Irish dancing, whatever, you know, school shows, all that kind of stuff. So it gives you that flexibility. And the life, your quality life balance is really important, your work-life balance. Owning your own business gives you the ability to determine your future and put the hours into your family. And I've been lucky enough to be able to do that. And it's just reaped huge rewards from me personally. And now I'm a grandfather, so I'm now getting the benefits of that as well. And I've even more time then with my granddaughter. Make sure you have enough capital. I said that earlier on to young people starting out. Make sure you have enough capital. Be sure you're able to deal with the lows, because there are more lows than our highs. The highs are fantastic. But I learned that when I started sales was for every 10 cold calls you did, you got one prospect. For every 10 demonstrations you did, you got one sale. So take the rejection, but be able then try and bring your success rate up. So I managed to bring it up to, for every 10 demos, I got about 6 or 7 sales. So bring your conversion rate.
Yeah. What do you think gets more credit for your success, luck or hard work?
Hard work.
Yeah.
I have had luck.
Yeah.
But the harder you work, the luckier you get.
Yeah, definitely the case. Now, I'm always interested in this one, and I'd be interested for you one, right? We're going to have a dinner party. There's 6 people. There's you, me, and 4 others. And the 4 others are your choice. Who comes to dinner?
I'd bring my wife
to
dinner. I'd bring Richard Branson.
Right.
I'd bring
Nelson. It's the second time his name has appeared.
Is it?
Yeah.
I'd bring Nelson Mandela.
Okay.
Is he on it?
No, he hasn't been on it yet, no.
I'd bring Dennis O'Brien.
Okay.
Have I got 4
yet? Yeah, that's your 4. Yeah. No sports people.
No sports people.
Okay.
Not the, off the top of my head. No.
How do you think personal experiences or developments have shaped your leadership style?
How do I think
personal experiences or your personal development has shaped the way you are, the way you lead the businesses?
Well, I realize that I am old school, Aidan. Mm-hmm. So I'm not fluffy. I'm not great with respect to dealing with the younger people of today because I'm very, very, very direct. So my leadership styles made sure that I brought somebody in that blocks me from staff and enables a very happier environment. Yeah, because I'll say it as it is. And yeah. A lot of people like that. I mean, it's testament to the fact that my staff stayed with me so long that they were happy with my personality and they knew what they were getting. I told them straight to their face, very direct. I didn't pussyfoot or cushion or, you know.
But how much of that do you think is actually down, going back to what we were talking about earlier on about, you know, face-to-face sales, right? That there is, people do business with people. And irrespective of the SaaS model and things like that, I still fundamentally believe people do business with people and people work with people. And you know, there can't be that cloudy bit about it because then there's no, you know, trust sometimes breaks down between everything. And it's, you know, it's coming back to, if you act... Somebody said to me, I may have acted like an asshole, but I was a consistent asshole. Okay, yeah. yeah. It's that consistency, I suppose, is the important thing.
Yeah, no, it's really important. And I just do think that's important. And I guess that's one of the things I've learned in my career is I am very consistent. You can read me like a book and I'll be direct with you. And if you can take that, then we'll get on great.
Yeah. Right, we've come to that moment in time. The final question. I've no idea what it is. We'll open it up and see. All right. This actually is very apt. This is very apt because of the point that you've this year come to, right? If you were to go on a similar journey again, what two things would you do differently and why?
I've already answered what part of that, which was I would start off with more capital.
Yeah.
Without 100%, I would do that. And I would not be as trusting.
Okay.
And when I say by that, so we decided to go to the cloud. Microsoft introduced us to a company that had code conversion software. And they were going to convert BiggerAd Book to run in the cloud. And every month they showed us progress. We engaged with them. We agreed a fixed price contract, which was payable every month. And every month we went, they came, presented what they'd done and how far they were progressing. It was to be done within 12 months. We got to month 10 and the guy came in. He was ashen white, sweating. And he said, look, all those screens I've been showing you for the last 10 months, I just made them up. We haven't been able to do the conversion. Your software had 700,000 lines of code and it broke our system and we needed too many staff, which we couldn't afford to do the conversion, and we're actually going out of business. So that's a scenario where I took somebody at face value and I did that in a lot of cases because, as I said, I'm quite trusting, and I assume if somebody tells me they will do X, they will do X.
Or at least give you a heads up quicker than 10 months down the road.
Yeah. So there are two things I'd change. I'd be a little bit more...
How did you deal with that setback?
That's only one of several setbacks, Aidan. We could be here for another hour if I could tell you all the setbacks.
Your attitude to setback, dealing with setbacks?
Is take a little bit of time out. So whether that's going off for a walk, going for a run, going for a cycle, try and settle yourself down and then try and see if you can have a... think outside of the box moment, which, you know, I have, like that video, for example, where the four staff left, that just came to me. It was like the phoenix rising out of the ashes. In that case, it was just, what are we going to do? And we said, okay, we've tried to partner with another company. Let's not do that. Let's do it ourselves. So I put 18 developers in a software house in Belarus, and we wrote BiggerCloud in 8 months, which ultimately was the right decision because we had a fresh product written for the cloud as opposed to an old product converted to the cloud. So sometimes in life, things happen for a reason. That happened for a reason, but it was a costly mistake. Another costly mistake is we tried to list on the AIM in London, and we went out and did the roadshow. We were raising 5 million. We'd got 4.1 million by this Tuesday of the second week, and an Israeli company issued a profit warning, and all the small cap investors were running for cover, and our brokers couldn't fill the book. Yeah. However, in their pitch to us initially, they said, look, if we're short, we've got 50 offices around the UK and we'll go to Aidan, we'll get 50 grand off Aidan, we'll go to Mark, get 100 grand off him. So there that afternoon, the book was closing on the Friday. We said, can you make those phone calls? Oh, no, 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 we can't make those phone calls. I said, what do you mean you can't make those phone calls? Oh, we can't make that. We found out in hindsight, they were selling their corporate finance division and they themselves were under due diligence and they couldn't be seen to be going off piste. But like we had taken from the word in their presentation that they were going to do this.
Don't trust
and,
people.
Yeah, exactly. And up to that point in time, Aidan, they had done everything to get a deal listed on the stock exchange. Yeah, yeah. But we were just one of those. So we've had setbacks and they're the two answers to your questions.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Mark O'Dwyer. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and we'll see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.